So good evening, everyone. It's good to see all of you. Tonight, Bible study is going to be about the priesthood. So if everybody would mute, then that will allow us to go ahead and do this without any, hopefully, unusual noises. But what we're going to do is going to have a PowerPoint. So I'm going to make my presentation using a PowerPoint, and Paul Rowe will actually advance the slides, and hopefully you'll find it profitable. So if Paul's ready, then we can go ahead and get started and bring up the title slide. So we've been talking about the high priest and the priesthood, and so we're going to continue that, but we're going to look at some physical things about the garments of the priest and their attire and its symbolism. So we're going to talk about some of that this evening. And as we look at some of the pictures that go along with this, you just have to realize that some of it we know by looking at the scriptures, and some of it people look at the scriptures and then seek to figure out exactly what is meant by the different things that are said. So some of this is we're not able to pin it down perfectly, but my goal is that you would see some of what Israel saw, and hopefully you'll better understand what God was trying to achieve when He established the tabernacle and the priesthood and the garments and things that they wore. It was all for a very important purpose in His dealing with His physical covenant people. So as you look at one thing I wanted to announce before we move on, and that is that Desi Long fell this morning. It was still dark and she fell, and so she is bruised and sore, but she did not break anything. So I sent her an anointed cloth, and you might pray for her to get better. So anyway, I talked to her, and she's getting along okay, but she still needs your prayers. So let's go to the next slide. And what this portrays is Israel coming out of Egypt. And you know, when you're looking for a slide that's going to convey what you want, sometimes it's kind of hard to find the exact slide that conveys that. But as far as Israel coming out of Egypt, God led Israel out, but with a flaming fire by night and a cloud by day. So so this gives you an idea of what it was like at night. You can see the stars out there, and the path was illuminated for the people of Israel as they made their way out of Egypt, beginning on the 15th day of the seventh month. So as God brought Israel out, He began to organize the nation. I mean, when they left, God had them organized. They didn't just everybody, you know, like the Sooners in Oklahoma, they didn't just run across the border and head in to find their parcel of land. And it's, you know, people running into each other and wagons are breaking down. It was a much more organized thing that God had them do. He had a certain tribe start first, and He set up things to be done in order, and they continued in that order as they made their way toward the promised land. So God begins working with His people by giving Israel His laws, His statutes, and judgments, which He did at Mount Sinai, and then He moves on to organizing the nation on the religious front. And up until this time, there were individual worshipers of God among the descendants of Abraham. As you look at Abraham, Abraham worshiped God, but it was a relationship between God and Abraham, and Abraham was the head of his household, and people worshiped God based upon the pattern that they saw Abraham carrying out. And Jacob did the same thing. Isaac did the same thing. So they were the heads of their household. They were the patriarchs. And religion was defined for them by what the patriarch handed down. But up until this time, the worship of God had been more or less individual. But while Israel was in Egypt, the nation became large, and as they headed out of Egypt, then the opportunity, then God needed to organize them, which he began to do, and he began to organize their religious worship. So, what happens when you just let everybody define it for themselves is that you have every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. And that's not what God wanted. God wanted a uniformity in his worship and not everybody doing whatever they wanted to do. So let's go to the next slide, and we might ask a question. How would Israel have organized religiously if it had been left up to them? Well, all you have to do is go forward a little bit after the giving of the Ten Commandments and look at the fact that Moses is up on the mountain, and what did they do? Did they form, they organize their own religion? They absolutely did. And a lot of times when people begin to practice religion, they'll look around and see what other people are doing, and that's exactly what Israel did. They looked back to Egypt and said, hey, this is how the Egyptians worship God, and they chose a cow, which was very common in Egypt and a very prominent god in Egypt. And so they chose not a cow, but a bull. And Moses is up on the mountain, and God knows what they're doing and sends Moses back down in order to correct the problem. But that this tells you what people do when it's left up to them. They will make their choices, and usually it'll be whatever comes out of the human mind. And so this is what Aaron came up with, was the golden calf, and then all of the people in worshiping the calf get involved with a great big huge party, and Moses comes down to find this going on, and he's quite angry and shuts that whole process down. But as you look at what's happening in our time, it's interesting that man is moving away from God. He's moving away from the Bible. And as man moves away from God and the Bible, then man is going to define religion for himself. It's going to be whatever man comes up with. And man not being tied into the Bible and having it as a guide, it's going to be very easy for mankind to be deceived, to be led astray. And that's why the beast and the false prophet are going to be very effective in influencing the world, to influence the world and to lead the world away from God. And basically, the world's going to go toward disaster, unfortunately. So where does God begin in his organization of the nation religiously? So God didn't just leave it up to them. So God organized things, and he did it in a very careful way. So as you look at Exodus chapter 25, it tells us that Israel had spoiled Egypt, and they came out of Egypt, and they were quite wealthy. And so he tells them to bring me an offering. For everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. So they came and they gave an offering, and from that offering, God was going to set up the things that he wanted done religiously. And he used that offering in order to accomplish that. And so Israel provided all these different things, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the blue, purple, and scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, badger skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, all these different things they had gotten from their time in Egypt, and all of those things were given in order that that to please God and then to go forward there and develop the religious practices that Israel would implement. So the next thing that they did, as we've looked at, they built a sanctuary. And we would know it as the tabernacle. So they They built the tabernacle. And it's interesting that it's called the tabernacle. And that's where God dwelled in Israel, in the tabernacle. And it's interesting that as you go forward to the New Testament, one of the points that's made by the Apostle John is that God came and tabernacled with men. And it makes you, and who is he talking about? He's talking about Jesus Christ. So as you look at that, who was tabernacling with them back in the Old Testament? It was Jesus Christ. Because the focal point of what John is saying is Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ's submission and carrying out of the will of God. And that is a constant theme throughout the book of John. As you look at verse 9, God had as he thought about the tabernacle that was to be built, he had a very specific pattern in mind, and he wanted it built a certain way, and he wanted certain things to be used. Wherever you would like. So anyway, he had a certain pattern, and he gave that pattern to Moses, and then Moses farmed out that responsibility to various people that were able to do the handiwork. And we're not going to spend too much time on the sanctuary tonight. We're going to focus more on the garments and the outfits that they wore. And then as you go, beginning in Exodus 25, verse 10, and ending in chapter 27, verse 20, God spelled out the tabernacle and its furnishings. And God further elaborated on this setup in other chapters in Exodus. So we'll take a look at those at another time. But we're going to continue with looking at the garments that the priest wore. So why does God establish a religious center for the nation? Why do that? And as you look at the picture here, it's a portrayal of the way things were as God set it up. You had certain tribes on the right side, to the north, to the south, and to the east. You had certain tribes in each of those positions, and that as Israel traveled, the center point was the tabernacle, and when they would set up camp, they would set up the tabernacle, and then the various tribes knew their position, and they would just go to that position. And as people became familiar with the setup, and the first time, it's a little confusing, a little distressing, but as you do it time after time, you learn what the pattern is, you follow the pattern, and it makes it easy. It becomes routine for you. So the tabernacle was the place where God dwelled, and it will be where God rules from, and God's intention is for his people to be focused there. So God dwelled. You see the little cloud up above the tent there, and that is a portrayal of God above the tabernacle. And so God, that's where God dwelled, and that's where God wanted the people of Israel to be focused, because as they were focused on the tabernacle, they could be focused upon God. So let's go to the next slide. So as you think about the tabernacle being set up in the middle of the camp of Israel, as you go forward into the millennium, as Christ returns, then he's going to set up a similar a much more spectacular tabernacle, but the same principle. And this is going to be the central place of worship that will be established in Jerusalem. In the millennial kingdom, Christ will establish his throne in Jerusalem, and shortly thereafter, the temple will be built. And Jerusalem will be where God dwells, and God will point man to the center of worship. So as people leave the city of Jerusalem and venture out in God's service, then where are they going to point human beings? They're going to point Israel to Jerusalem and the temple. They're going to go to other nations, and they're going to do the same thing. It's all going to be a focus upon God, and God is going to focus them there so that they realize there is one God and he dwells in Jerusalem. And God is going to make sure that that this idea is established among the people on the earth. If you want more details on the temple that will be established, you can look at Ezekiel chapter 40 and the chapters following. And this particular portrayal is one that I found on the church's website for in dealing with Ezekiel 40 and beyond. So it gives you a portrayal of what the temple may look like in the time of after the return of Jesus Christ. So on what does God focus next after the tabernacle? So this is in the future, and God will have a priesthood, and God will have a tabernacle in the millennial kingdom. And interestingly, there will be sacrifices made. And I've talked about that in a Bible study a few years ago, but that is something that will be taking place among the people of God at that time. And they will establish a priesthood, and then, you know, we God's children will not be the priesthood. They'll have physical people carrying that out, but we will be pointing people toward God and the tabernacle, and it will all be toward helping people to develop a relationship with God. So as you look at how God set up the tabernacle and the temple and how he will set up the temple in the future, in no time has the temple service been a self-service project. God didn't say, you guys can do whatever you want in your own community. God allowed that when they first started, and then he began to focus them toward a central location. And the reason he's doing that is because he wants them to recognize there is a God in heaven, and he is the one true God, and they are to look to him. So it's all geared toward a purpose of man developing a relationship with the one true God, and God is consistent in the approach that he uses. He did it with the tabernacle, he did it with the temple, and he's going to do it in the millennial kingdom. And it's going to be exciting to see all of this unfold. Now let's go to Exodus chapter 28 and look at verses 1 and 2. So God has talked about setting up the temple, but he's also going to establish a priesthood, as we've talked about. So the first thing God sets up is the priesthood, with Aaron as the high priest and his sons being priests as well. And we read of this in Exodus 28, verses 1 and 2. Now take Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister to me as priest. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. So they established the priesthood, and Aaron was the first high priest, and then his sons also served in the priesthood. They had certain responsibilities that they oversaw, as we talked about in the last sermon on the priesthood, and we know that Nadab and Abihu, they had certain priestly duties, but unfortunately, they figured, hey, fire's fire, and you know, God makes mention of the fact that when you're on duty, absolutely don't be drinking, because when you're drinking, you don't make good decisions. And obviously, they made a poor decision when they decided, hey, the fire went out, big deal, we'll just get some other fire. And God said, no, that's not how I wanted it done. And he killed both of them. And I think after that, Aaron took it very seriously, as did Eleazar and Ithamar, in order to make sure they did not go against what God had ordained. Now let's go to the next slide. And so we see that God told Moses he says, you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. Now, as you think about these garments that were made for glory and beauty, well, they were to be glorious and beautiful from a physical standpoint, but they were to point to something much bigger that they represented. And as we go to the book of Revelation, we are given access to God's throne and the glory that is there, the brightness and the beauty and the colors and all of the things that are part of God's throne we're given a vision of that. And what we see with what God wanted to see with the priesthood are his priest dressed gloriously. See, the high priest dressed gloriously. Why? Because he's the representative of Jesus Christ. This is your eventual savior. And he serves as high priest at God's right hand, and he wanted them to understand this. And for them, they were a physical people, and it was very helpful for them to see these physical things and then to say this is a portrayal of God's throne and God's way of, you know, God's servant, Jesus Christ. They didn't know him as Jesus Christ. They knew him as Yahweh, but he served as priest. Verse 3 says, so you shall speak to all who are gifted artisans. So I want the very best artisans to make these garments. I want them to be spectacularly beautiful, so when people see them, they will be impressed. And it will give them an idea of my throne and the glory of that throne that they can see, at least catch a glimpse of. So he wanted these artisans whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister to me as priest. So Aaron was the high priest, and he was a type of Jesus Christ, and he was to have a glorious appearance. And these garments were made for him to put on. And you can see they were bright and they were beautiful. Now, I don't believe the portrayal here is exactly correct, but it gives you a general idea, as we'll see as we look at more specifics. And the reason that these things were made, as I said, was for glory and beauty. And as you look at God's throne, it is a glorious and beautiful throne that we can look to and look at and think about as we think about the book of Revelation. And it's talking about these garments as being holy. So when they're holy, what does that mean? Well, as you look at their clothes, and there's nothing inherent holiness in them. They're just physical garments, but they represented something that was holy. They're called holy simply because they were not worn on ordinary occasions. You didn't just wear this. This wasn't an everyday outfit. This was an outfit that was worn on special occasions, most especially on the day when the high priest on the Day of Atonement would go into the Holy of Holies. And it was meant to be something beautiful and representing the holiness of God. And the high priest was set apart in a unique way. He was anointed with oil, and as that oil was poured on his head, it set him apart for God's special use. So let's go to the next slide. So as you think about, you had the high priest, and then you had the ordinary priest. And as you look at the ordinary priest, they wore certain garments. They each wore white linen breeches. They wore white linen garments, a white linen sash. Now, I've seen the white linen sash, and I've seen the red sash, and I've seen the multicolored sash. So I'm not sure which one it is. I think people take a license with what they think it was. And they had a white turban. And so that would be what the ordinary priest would wear. And then you would have... The high priest wore those white garments along with an ephod, which I'll explain here shortly, a breastplate, a mitre with a golden crown, and a blue tunic. So these are the things that the high priest would wear, and he wore everything that the ordinary priest wore, but he also had certain garments that were unique to the high priest because of the uniqueness of the one who is our high priest, Jesus Christ. So as you look at, uh, as you look at this, it's kind of interesting. So let's move forward to the next picture. So you can see the white garments that were worn by the regular priest. And you can see that this is a portrayal. It's not my favorite, but it is a portrayal of the high priest's garments and what he wore. And you can see they're very distinct and much more colorful than what the regular feast wore. So let's go to the next slide. So we're going to talk about the ephod. And, you know, the ephod, as you look at that particular word in English, it seems strange to us. We don't know. I don't know what an ephod is. I'd never thought about it much. But once I started to look into the subject of the high priest, then I began to understand it more, and it's quite an interesting garment. And so as you look, and it's described beginning in Exodus chapter 28, verse 5, and the description continues on down to verse 13. And as you look at it, you can see that there were threads that were all woven together, red and white and gold and blue. Like it says, they shall take gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread and the fine linen, and they would weave them all together. And it was done in an artistic and beautiful way. And what you see in that particular picture is just a portrayal of what it may have looked like. And you can see how I think really, you know, as you look at God's glory, it radiates. And I think it's a portrayal of God's glory radiating here, you know, because it is a portrayal of an eternal being, Jesus Christ, who does radiate. And so you see that the ephod here was made of two parts. So they wove one part, and then what they did is they joined the two parts together. And then it says, it shall have two shoulder straps joined at its edges, and so it shall be joined together. And the intricately woven band of the ephod, which is on it, shall be of the same workmanship, made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen. So God picked these colors, and he picked this woven garment for a reason, because from God's perspective, it portrayed his son as our high priest. And so he wanted that portrayed before the people of Israel so they would have some understanding of God. And the person is just a man, it's just a physical garment, but it's hopefully giving them some vision of what God's working out. Now, as you look here, you see upon the shoulder of this ephod a couple of gold settings, and on the shoulders you had two onyx stones that were set on that. It says in verse 9, then you shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on one stone and six names on the other stone in order of their birth. So these stones were on the shoulders of the high priest, and there's a reason for that. And as you look at the front of the vest or the breastplate was fastened to the shoulder straps by two golden chains and a blue cord. So you had, this was all designed by God, and God made sure that it was all done properly. In later years, ephods were worn by associate priests as well as the high priest. You find out about that in 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 18. And even the boy Samuel, dedicated to serve in Shiloh, wore an ephod. David, although not a priest, wore an ephod when he brought the ark to Jerusalem. And David was given the opportunity for certain priestly responsibilities because David was a fleshly type of the coming Jesus Christ. So let's move to the next slide, if we would. The ephod was to be made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread? And what part of the tabernacle employed the same colors? And I picked this particular portrayal, not that it's absolutely the perfect example, but I picked it because of the red and the blue. And as you look at what's in the, on the ceiling, you can see it kind of radiating out. And I think that that's what God was trying to portray here as he set all this up. So as you look at chapter 28, verse 6, it says it was to be made of gold, hyacinth, artistically woven of the same material, therefore as the inner drapery and curtain of the tabernacle, but instead of having the figures of cherubim woven into it, it was to be worked throughout with gold thread. So you set up these two images of the cherubim, and it was all to be portraying God's throne, because what's right on the other side of that curtain? Right on the other side of that curtain is the Ark of the Covenant. And what do you find at the Ark of the Covenant, at God's throne? You find cherubim. And so this is just giving the people of Israel a certain level of understanding. And the people of Israel, I don't know that any members of the congregation actually came inside the holy place. If they saw anything, it had to be because the tent was door was opened, or the drape was pulled back where they could see inside. And they couldn't see beyond that tent or that curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place. So they didn't have the opportunity to be able to see. They could just see that there was a curtain there and what's beyond the curtain. And I'm sure that they heard of the Ark of the Covenant and the cherubim that were on it, and the golden, all the gold that was in there. And as you lit up that room, the gold would be spectacular. I think one of the most spectacular opportunities I ever had to experience seeing a lot of gold was in Bogota, Colombia. They had the El Museo del Oro, and you could go in there, and it was like a safe. So they would open it, you could go in, you could look, and then you had to come out. And it was brightly lit, and it was amazing, all of that gold and its reflection throughout the room. And I could just imagine the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant, how it would shine with great brightness and would just be spectacular, like God's throne would be. So let's go to the next slide. And we see here gemstones on the shoulders of the ephod. And we've talked about these here briefly. And in describing the making of the ephod in Exodus 28, verses 9 and 10, the names of the sons of Israel were placed on two stones. And they were placed on two stones. Josephus states clearly that the stone on the breastplate was onyx, and the shoulder pieces of the ephod sardonyx, the variety of onyx with the bands of dark red, and that's from Unger's Bible Dictionary. So you had the ephod, and you see the two gemstones on the shoulders, and then I set aside got a picture of one of them. And these are the tribes of Israel listed here. You had six of them on this stone, and you had six on the other. And you see the blue garment here that was part of the priestly accoutrements. So they were placed in the order of birth. On one, you had the children of Leah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. And then you had the children of Bilhah, Dan, and Naphtali. On the other, the children of Zilpah, Gad, Asher, and then the children of Leah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Joseph and Benjamin. So you had these two sardonic stones that were on the shoulders of the priest. And as you think about those stones, that stone and the names of the people of the children of Israel on the two stones, what is that portraying? What is that portraying? You might think about it this way. Why would they be on the shoulders of the high priest? As you look at this portrayal, they were displayed this particular way to not to exalt the high priest's position or to display his beautiful robes, but to represent the people before the Lord and carry them on his shoulders. He had been, the high priest had been called not to serve himself, but to serve the people. And so his role and responsibility as an intercessor for the people of Israel was basically, in a sense, to carry them on his shoulders. So that was what a physical man who served as high priest was to do, but it portrayed what Jesus Christ has done for you and me. He carries us on his shoulders. He carries us on his shoulders, and we can be thankful that his shoulders are broad and he is able to carry us. Now let's go on next to the breastplate, the breastplate. And let's read verses 15 through 30, Exodus 28, verses 15 through 30. First of all, then we'll come back to this particular picture. So you shall make the breastplate of judgment. The breastplate was for judgment. And we'll talk about judgment here next time because it involves the Urim and Thummim, and we'll try to better understand that. But artistically woven according to the workmanship of the ephod, you shall make it of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen you shall make it. It shall be doubled into a square, a span shall it be its length, and a span shall be its width. And that span would be about 9 inches. The second row shall be turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, hyacinth, an agate, and an amethyst, and the fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold settings. And the stone shall have the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engravings of a signet, which would be a ring, each one with its own name, and they shall be according to the 12 tribes. So as you look at this, of what cloth was the breast piece made? Well, it was made of the same cloth as the ephod, and it was to be 9 inches, which is a span or half a cubit, square with 12 precious stones in gold, settings mounted in 4 rows of 3 stones each. On each stone was to be engraved the name of one of the tribes of Israel, probably in the same sequence as the names engraved on the stones. And let's go to the next slide. And you can see here you can see the breastplate, and then let's go to the next slide. There we go. And you can see the order according to Numbers 10. You had stone there that was for Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. You had Dan, Naphtali, and Gad, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, and Asher, Joseph, and Benjamin. And you know, that being that the way that you do Hebrew, it doesn't go left to right like we do. It goes right to left. And so it's moving in an opposite direction for all of us, and it's something to keep in mind. Also, this order is an opinion. You can find several different concepts as to what order is correct. So these stones are probably arranged in the order of which the tribes marched, which we've talked about already. Let's go to chapter 28, verse 22. Chapter 28, verse 22. So this, it says, you shall make chains for the breastplate at the end, like braided cords of pure gold. And you shall make 2 rings of gold for the breastplate, and put the 2 rings on the 2 ends of the breastplate. Then you shall put the two braided chains of gold in the two rings, which are on the ends of the breastplate, and the other two ends on the other two other ends of the two braided chains you shall fasten to the two settings, and put them on the shoulder straps of the ephod in front. So God's very precise in how he wants this to be, and we look at the next slide, and you can see the breastplate, you can see the work that was done for weaving in order to make it with the special cloth, with the gold and everything in it, and then you see the precious stones, each one representing one of the tribes. And so you could see that this was all done, and it's interesting where this was placed. Just as the high priest carried Israel, in a sense, on his shoulders, as you look at the breastplate, it's right over the high priest's heart. And as you think about that, it was a way that that God portrayed his love for his people and his service to the people, because all of those people were right over the one who is a representative of our high priest in heaven, his heart. The breast piece over Aaron's heart occurs three times in these verses and was to serve as a continuing memorial before the Lord. So the high priest not only carried the people on his shoulders, but he also carried them over his heart. And if we don't have sincere love in our hearts, we won't be concerned about the needs of others, and we won't want to help them. As it says in 1 John chapter 4, verse 18, it says, "My little children, let us not love in word and deed. Let us not love in word and deed, but in deed and in truth." And that's what the high priest was, to be a servant and to love the people of God and to love them in the right way. And that's exactly how Jesus Christ loves you and I. We're very close to his heart, in a sense. He carries us on his shoulders. And and God has us, so we are very close. We're very precious to God, and he keeps us close. As you think about, a person who's pastoring a church, then we are to love God's people, and we are to be reminded of the way Christ serves us at God's throne, and it's the way that we are to serve one another, and that's the way the ministry is to serve the people of God. As we have already talked about, we are a holy priesthood and a royal priesthood, but we must constantly be a loving priesthood, and it's a demanding job. And as you look at go back to ancient Israel and how things were done, and in that time, it was a type of what is being accomplished through Jesus Christ. And as you look at the millennial kingdom, which we're going to celebrate here in a few weeks, it's all about our high priest, who's serving right now at God's right hand, returning, setting up his kingdom, and he will be the high priest for all people on the earth, making intercession for all people. And because he is God, he's going to be able to carry us on his shoulders, and he's going to keep us close to his heart. And so we can rejoice in what God is working out here below. So that gives us some idea about how all of this is worked out. I think to me it's very encouraging. A lot of times we don't spend much time on this because we read it and we don't think about it, but it is, one of the blessings of living in the 21st century is you can go online and you can actually find portrayals of different things. Some of them aren't right, but some of them give you some idea of what was taking place here. And as I remember people have asked me, why are we talking about this? It has nothing to do with my life. But it's interesting that who inspired the scriptures? Who inspired this to be written down? And he didn't, and God did not inspire it to be written down just for the Old Testament people of Israel. He inspired it for me and you because as we understand something about it, then we can understand what God was trying to represent to the people of Israel. And then we can understand it and we can get some concept of what God is trying to do for you and me. So we don't want to obsess about it, but we can understand some basic things about it which are helpful and encouraging. And it reminds us that God cared for the people of God. He never, ever just had no thought of them. He always thought of them and cared for them. And he put up with a great deal before he sent them into captivity. And even though he sent them into captivity, he still has a plan that he's going to work out with them at the return of Jesus Christ. So hopefully that gives you a little better understanding of some things about the priesthood and the garments that they wore and what they represented. So next week we'll continue this and we'll look at some of the other garments, starting with the Urim and Thummim. The Urim and Thummim is kind of a very interesting part of the clothing of the high priest, but we don't understand it fully. But we'll talk about it and see what we can understand, and hopefully it will you'll find it interesting. And you know, I've found this all very interesting, and hopefully you do too. And I thank you for joining us this evening, and hopefully you found it profitable. So we'll look forward to seeing those who are able to make it to services on Sabbath. And then next Wednesday, we'll take up Bible study again. So thanks, everybody, for joining us, and please have a great remainder of the week.